And welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, a regular feature of the ERS Respiratory Channel. The topic of this podcast is treatment of drug-susceptible and drug-resistant tuberculosis, where we are and where we go. My name is Giovanni Battista Migliori, and I will be leading the discussion today. I'm a specialist in respiratory medicine and medical statistics, with more than 30 years of global experience in technical assistance, research, and training. I'm so happy that today two wonderful colleagues and dear friends are joining me in this interesting discussion. They are Onno Ackermann and Simon Tiberi. To note that both Onno and Simon are just for 2 to 3 years ex-ERS early career members. So young, but not that super young now, this testifying the success that this ERS project has achieved. Onno is a chest physician. He combines clinical work and important research at the Department of Pulmonology, Diseases and Tuberculosis at the University Medical Center of Groningen in the Netherlands. Simon is infectious disease expert by training, is now a global health physician at GSK, an honorary consultant and honorary clinical reader in infectious diseases at Barts Health NHS Trust and Queen Mary University of London. Onno and Simon, you are most welcome. Tuberculosis continues to be a global emergency with more than 10 million new cases every year and 1.5 million deaths. In 2020, WHO estimated that only about one third of the existing multidrug-resistant TB cases were detected and reported, and not even all of them were treated. That's really dramatic. And there is increasing evidence that COVID made a disaster, reducing dramatically access to TB services and therefore reducing the capacity of diagnosing both TB and TB infection by even 20, 30, 40%, depending on which country, right? Comparing with the pre-COVID year. This also hampered the quality of TB services and caused an increased mortality. Clearly, the treatment of TB, both of drug-susceptible and drug-resistant TB, was really affected. And this is why I think it's important we discuss with our friends Onno and Simon about that. So we'll start discussing a little bit about drug-susceptible TB, and then we move to drug-resistant TB. Simon, we have news on treatment of drug-susceptible TB, right? So for ages, it has been long, 1 year, 9 months, 6 months. And now we have, let's say, hope to be able to show that to 4 months. And there are two new trials there, the SHINE trial and the study 31. Can you tell us a bit more on that?
Thank you, GB. Yes, indeed. We have two exciting landmark phase three studies, which brought some amazing news that we can shorten the duration of drug-susceptible TB treatment from 6 months to 4 months in two populations, in the pediatric population with SHINE and in adults and adolescents with the ACTG TBTC 31 study. And these two studies, large phase three studies, SHINE showed that you can reduce the continuation phase of treatment of 4 months to 2 months with two or three drugs. And this is very, very good. What it allows us to do as clinicians is reduce the duration of treatment in patients with minimal disease, in patients who have smear negative disease. And therefore, what you're doing is you're shortening the treatment times for these patients, and they have the same outcomes of patients receiving 6 months. So this is a godsend for children and for programs because it reduces burden, it reduces suffering, and it gives the same outcomes. And then study 31, this was a large phase three RCT that was conducted by the Tuberculosis Trials Consortium. And they found that giving a 4 month regimen with rifapentine and moxifloxacin in the place of pyrazinamide and ethambutol was non-inferior to a six-month regimen. So what they did was they gave rifapentine, moxifloxacin, isoniazid, and pyrazinamide in the first 2 months. And then for the last 2 months, they gave rifapentine, moxifloxacin, and isoniazid. And what they showed was that was non-inferior. And this was a four-month regimen. And this was also for patients with an important burden of disease. And so this is a very important study because it can also revolutionize the way we treat drug-susceptible TB with rifapentine.
Very good. So we know you are very passionate about clinical trials, right? And basically, we have three or four regimens overall for drug-susceptible TB because there is also the option to omit salmeterol, right, in one of these regimens.
Exactly. So we have the HRZE regimen, which is our standard of care at the moment, 6 months. We have now the rifapentine isoniazid pyrazinamide amoxifloxacin for 4 months, if that's recommended. And then in SHINE, we have two possibilities of either HRZ or HRZE. And so there are two combinations also in SHINE.
Very good. Oh, no, you are also passionate about children, etc. Children are an important target, right? Which are the specific differences in these two trials as far as the age groups are concerned?
Yes, thank you, GB. And I think it's not only about age, but perhaps weight band dosing is even more important. And it's what you see when you see the exposure of the drugs as well. I think what we can learn from the pharmacokinetic study of the SHINE trial is that what we saw from the weight band dosing, that the exposure of the drugs was lower when we dosed lower per weight. So in the end, I think it's not age related, but I think weight will be more important for the children, perhaps for the adolescents and adults as well.
In your research, actually, you are working a lot on TDM, right? So on dosing the drugs in the blood and try to optimizing that. Can you tell us a little bit more on this? Because I think this will be very much the future.
Yeah, I think so too. And especially for the more vulnerable groups who are at risk of treatment failure, of lower exposure. And as I said before, I think it's also in the what we saw from the SHINE trial was that the lower weight children or the more ill children had lower exposure. And that's what we see also in the adults who we are treating. And we are trying to look at the exposure of the different drugs in their blood. That's what we call the therapeutic drug monitoring. And there is a large variance in the exposure of the different drugs, especially of rifampicin in the adults. And it's dependent on absorption of the drugs, which you can imagine that somebody is very ill have lower absorption compared to somebody who's less ill. For example, the patients admitted to an ICU ward needs higher drug dosing or IV drugs because the normal dose, they won't absorb that much compared to the normal patients. As well, we see the same for the patients, for example, with HIV or diabetes. They have a different profile of exposure compared to the other groups of TB. So we have to select those groups at risk of failing treatment. And what we know that the pharmacokinetic profile of them are different to the normal patients. And then we can optimize those by higher dosing or, in the case of drug-resistant TB, which we will discuss later, reduce the toxicity of those drugs.
By the way, the ERJ has recently published two papers of the Global Tuberculosis Network, one on the impact on TB services, published in the issue of December, and one just coming in the March issue on the clinical impact and on mortality. Now, I think it's important we give a look to what is new in the area of drug-resistant, multidrug-resistant TB. Simon, there are a couple of new trials, right? And the TB Practical, which is a trial coordinated by MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, is involving new drugs together with some old drugs. So we have bedaquiline, pertominid, linezolid, with or without moxi or clofazimine. Can you tell us more on this trial?
Yes, absolutely, GB. It's another landmark trial, a phase two, phase three trial, which compared 6 months of BPAL with 6 months of BPAL plus clofazimine or 6 months of BPAL and moxifloxacin and compared that to standard of care MDR-TB treatment. And what is important about TB Practical was that it was carrying on from NIX-TB, obviously different organizations, but they took BPAL and they had a control group. So they made an RCT trial for this. So finally, we have this data. We can compare BPAL with a WHO regimen and not with the historical controls as NIX-TB. And furthermore, two more regimens with a fourth drug, either clofazimine or moxifloxacin, were added. And what's interesting with this trial, which the results were reported at the last union meeting, and we're still waiting on the publication, what's so important about this was that the six-month BPALM regimen was considered to be better than the other two arms and the WHO standard of care regimen. And the data sharing board, the DMSB, told the trial to stop and to report their results. So this is another important area, because what we know now is that BPAL, yes, was effective in comparison to WHO standard of care, but there's a regimen which is even more effective with the addition of moxifloxacin to BPAL. And so this is a very important study, which I'm sure in the coming months with the publication will bring a lot of interest into seeing how we can progress further with this regimen in the treatment of drug-resistant TB.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And still in the area of using this new drug, bedaquiline nasally pretominate, there is another trial which is led by University of Cape Town in South Africa.
This is also a very important study, which is already started, or the first plans were 2014-2015, and they still wanted to compare an injectable, including a regimen, to an all-oral regimen of 6 to 9 months. So they wanted to compare an intensive phase, including an injectable of 6 to 8 months, with a follow-up continuation phase of 18 months, including moxifloxacin, pyrazinamide, etionamide, and tiridazone, comparing to 6 to 9 months of linezolid, bedaquiline, and levofloxacin, though in a lower dose than nowadays recommended by the WHO, including pyrazinamide high dose of isoniazid and etionamide. And the thing is that they don't have the same follow-up time for both groups. So we are still waiting for the publication of this regimen, but I think the regimen with the 6 to 9 months oral drugs will be compared in the near future with the BPOL or the BPOLM regimen Simon was discussing about, because that will be the way forward, to have the all oral regimens 6 to 9 months, and we should compare them under trial conditions, and then we can compare those results.
Very good. Now there is another important trial, Simon, that we need to comment briefly, which is the Xenix trial, which is led by the TB Alliance. What can you tell us on this?
So the Xenix study was from the same investigators of the Nix TB study, and what they decided to do with this phase three trial was design a study to improve the safety and tolerability of BPAL by optimizing the dose and duration of linezolid. Linezolid, as we all know, is a drug which we believe is very effective. However, it comes with a toxicity cost. And we saw that in Nix-TB, with a large proportion of patients developing either bone marrow toxicity or peripheral neuropathy with linezolid. That in Nix-TB was dosed at 1,200 milligrams once daily. In clinical practice, many centers give 600 milligrams once daily of linezolid, but that's not backed up on trial data. And so Xenix would deliver evidence of how we could reduce the dose of linezolid while still retaining efficacy. And in that trial, they had several different arms. They had a linezolid 1,200 milligram arm for 26 weeks, a linezolid 1,200 milligram arm for 9 weeks, a 600 milligram arm for 26 weeks, and a linezolid arm, 600 milligram arm for 9 weeks. And what they found was that you had less toxicity giving a lower dose of linezolid for a lower period of time, and you still had a good amount of efficacy in having the lower dose of linezolid. And therefore, this is an important study which also shows that we can use linezolid differently.
Okay, it's interesting to see how much now the discussion is going on that, considering that we published our first paper in 2007, right? I think together, showing that 600 milligrams was less toxic and more or less had the same efficacy, right, than the 1.2 grams.
Yes, indeed, we did. It was on retrospective data. But yes, we had the hunch that potentially linezolid could be used more sparingly or used periodically for shorter periods of time. So the idea we had a decade ago was that we could hit hard and complete a shorter course of linezolid once we saw the patients improve, have sputum smear culture conversion. We could then stop or reduce the linezolid dose. So those were the considerations we had a decade ago, and which now we've seen with the results of Xenex to be correct.
Onno, a question to you. Probably 15 years ago, you have inaugurated the department in Groningen, right?
Almost 10 years ago.
Okay. It took 10 years to pronounce Groningen correctly. It's correct. It's so difficult to pronounce this in Dutch, right?
Indeed.
Now, I think it will be interesting if you can briefly comment on the, maybe according to what you think, the main requirements to ensure proper infection control in a department which is hosting patients who are potentially transmitting very dangerous strains, right?
Yes, indeed. And I think that's a very good question. And of course, we were very lucky that we had the possibilities to build a complete new TB center with the highest conditions possible for such a facility. We divided our center in two parts, one for the most infectious patients we had and for our less infectious patients. So the patients who are more infectious, they are in separate rooms, all rooms for one person with sluices, with air changes, preferably 12 air changes per hour. We have UV lights. We have lower air pressure in the rooms compared to the sluices and to the halls where we normally walk. But it's not the only thing. We also need a dedicated team paying attention and educating patients about the importance of the transmission of TB and taking the proper precautions. So cough hygiene is very important. Wearing the proper masks are very important. And when they do so, and we think it's possible, we also include them in our small society, in our ward, so they can help each other and pay attention to each other. So they can educate each other and stimulate and motivate each other as well, both to comply to the precautions we need to work safely for all our colleagues, but also to motivate each other, taking the drugs at the right times and each day.
Yeah. I think this is a really great example, and people really would have benefit in visiting such a well-organized department just to take inspiration on how organized own department. Another brief question, Onno. Part of your research is devoted to identify new ways of delivering anti-TB drugs. What can you tell us on the potentiality of the inhalation route?
Yeah, no, I think it's very important to look at new deliveries of drugs. And the inhalation of TB is one of our interests because it's what has already been done many, many years for other antimicrobial drugs. And we have a special interest, as discussed just before as well, in our ward to the isolation of TB patients, but also the contagiousness of TB patients. And we think one of the greater aims of inhalation of TB drugs is reducing the period of contagiousness for TB patients. And it's not only important in our settings, but it's extremely important in settings where we don't have all the facilities to diagnose the resistance pattern of the bugs in time. So we're starting treatment for a drug-susceptible TB, while in the end it might be a resistant form of TB. So in that time we are waiting for molecular susceptibility results. We can use inhalation of the different anti-TB drugs, in my hope and belief, to reduce transmissibility of the TB for those communities. So instead of isolation of a couple of weeks for patients, which will have an enormous impact on their life and their well-being especially. So with inhalation, we try to reduce that period and reduce transmission, which is at the moment the main driver for drug-resistant TB.
Thank you so much. So we follow with interest the progress of your research. Now, a question to Simon, which is I would like to make a little bit more personal question. Simon, as you are a recent ex-junior or early career member, right? And you were working with an academic role at the Queen Mary University in London, etc. And you maintained that, but you also entered a new experience with pharma. So do you have any message to share to our early career members, young colleagues, etc., on the possibilities or the importance or reflecting on your experience? I think this is important.
If you asked me that question 10 years ago, I would have given a completely different answer. But most definitely now in my 40s, having worked in infectious diseases, having done many clinics, having worked in different settings, gone through 2 years of COVID, I saw an opportunity to develop TB drugs. And I'm very privileged that I have this opportunity to work with GlaxoSmithKline that has a pipeline of new hopeful TB drugs and lots of collaborative partnerships like Unite4TB, Aero4TB. There's an opportunity to further change guidelines, further change the treatments of TB patients and improve TB treatments. We're more or less like the mid-90s for HIV, where the protease inhibitors had arrived in 95, 96, and that led to a renaissance of clinical trials in HIV medicine, which really transformed the way HIV is treated and managed. And I can see that happening with TB. It's really exciting. Finally, we have drugs in the pipeline, new drugs that we need to know how they work, if they can work better in particular combinations in different regimens. So I thought this was a very exciting time to move to pharma while still continuing clinical practice and academic pursuits. So I think it's exciting. And I would say to younger colleagues to not exclude pharma and research, especially in TB at this time.
So I think it's a good message for young people to consider that possibility as well, as pharma can give an important support to research, right? If done in a proper way. Oh no, I forgot one thing about TDM. One of the objections that sometimes clinicians do when they don't know the methodology well is how difficult or complicated it is to send a sample through mail, etc., far. Maybe it's expensive, maybe it's complicated. Can you explain in simple words what is needed to send a dry spot overseas and how relatively easy is also from Asia and Africa for special cases to make a test? That's for me so important.
Yes, thank you, GB. I think it's a very important question because, of course, it's easy for us to say in a well-organized setting. But nowadays, with the dry spot card you mentioned already, it's so easy. We only need a couple of drops from a finger prick two or three times just before and a couple of hours after taking the pills from the patient. We can dry it by a room temperature and then send it just by mail.
So sorry, this is just as we do for malaria, right?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. It's so easy to do nowadays. And luckily, we are getting many more laboratory facilities all over the world trying to implement the analysis of the anti-TB drug. So it will be just centers in the specific countries. And it's not only our center or some centers which can do it, but it's quite easy. And we're still developing and trying to limit the samples we just need to give proper advice for the drug dosing.
And it is relatively cheap, right?
Yeah, it's relatively cheap. And it will be cheaper when we do it more. And I think it's only 30 euros per sample set. We try to help the pharmacies in some countries to implement the analysis of anti-TB drugs in their pharmacy laboratories. So it will be only cheaper in the near future.
So thank you. I think we have revised a little bit the panorama of the main trials, which have impact on the guidelines that are going to be rewritten soon on drug-susceptible TB and on drug-resistant TB. So we know WHO is finalizing its guidelines for drug-susceptible TB. And we know that soon WHO will convene its expert to start working at an update version of the multidrug-resistant TB guidelines as this is necessary. And of course, the results of these trials in 1-2 years will require further adjustments because things are going, as Simon said, very, very rapidly. I think clinicians are being used to treat drug-susceptible TB for 6 months and multidrug-resistant TB for 2 years or a bit less than 2 years. And there was already the experience with the WHO shorter regimen or Bangladesh regimen, a reduction to 9 months. although not all, let's say, experts were fully enthusiastic of that regimen because some limitations were seen in it, particularly in areas with high rates of drug resistance. But anyway, it seems to me that the panorama now is that we are targeting 6 months for drug-resistant TB, multidrug-resistant TB, and we are targeting 4 months for drug-susceptible TB, which is a kind of dream compared to what we had, let's say, even 5 years ago. So next generations will benefit from the possibility really to shortening the treatment, and the patients largely will benefit from it. Oh, no, Simon, maybe you want to say something more, because I think we are living exciting times.
Absolutely, GB. I think it's not just a question of shortening duration, but also allowing for better access of these drugs and regimens and simplifying these regimens, making them safer and less toxic for patients. So I think it's several things that will be improving, hopefully, over the next few years in TB treatment. And maybe, who knows, a universal drug regimen, a pan-TB regimen that may simplify even further. We just treat TB for what it is, regardless of resistance, with new drugs that we haven't had a chance to create resistance yet.
Sure. Onno, what do you think?
Yes, no, I completely agree with both you, GB, and with Simon. It's an extremely exciting time to work in the TB field and doing research. And we can be very optimistic about the new developments in the treatment, but also the developments in the diagnostics and the access, as Simon said, to both the drugs and the new diagnostic technology. So I'm very hopeful for the near future for patients, but also for us as clinicians and researchers.
Thank you for joining us for this ERS podcast, unfortunately still done via an electronic platform due to the COVID. I really enjoyed taking part in it. And thank you to Onno and Simon for their contributions and insights on the topic. You can visit the ERS Respiratory channel each month for more podcasts featuring discussion between experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine.